Tonight you will be an ear witness as a guided missile soars 270 miles high in one of the most unusual recordings ever broadcast. On Hear It Now with Edward R. Murrow and the voices of President Harry Truman, General James Van Fleet, Senator Charles Tobey, the Duke of Windsor, Senator Robert Taft, and more than 40 other men and women in the news in the 24th performance of CBS's Document for Ear, presented tonight and every week at this time.
Think what a responsibility your president faces in a situation of this kind. If you'd think and think clearly on this subject, you'd get behind him.
I just want to say that the Senate Crime Investigating Committee will keep an eagle eye on this game. Be ye clean, even though your trousers be muddied on the playing field.
While a king's story is strictly nonfiction, I only wish that I had thought to add the old familiar ending of all romances, and they lived happily ever after.
Hear It Now. The Columbia Broadcasting System and 173 affiliated radio stations present a Document for Ear based on the week's news and the men and women who made it. All the voices and sounds you will hear are real and are presented as they were recorded in the heat and confusion of a world in crisis. Here is the editor of Hear It Now, the distinguished reporter and news analyst, Edward R. Murrow.
For 2 weeks, the men in the line in Korea had waited for phase number 2 in the communist spring offensive. As they waited, they bathed in the Han River, did their laundry, wrote letters, and spent 30 minutes a day with their non-coms brushing up on the nomenclature and use of that weapon which even the atom bomb hasn't outmoded, the bayonet.
Stab! Stab! Safeguard! Bergamot stroke! Bang! Poison on that stroke!
A week ago tonight, those bayonets went into action as the enemy counteroffensive got underway. Like the floodgates of a dam, the enemy opened its locks and sent the human sea against our lines. General Van Fleet described it this way.
The attack was initiated by a mammoth assault against UN forces in the East Central Sector. The weight of 5 Chinese Communist armies, as well as 3 North Korean corps, was thrown against Republic of Korea units and elements of the 10th Corps.
The entire 8th Army was ready for them. So were the infantry companies of the line. The bayonet training paid off. Beside the men with the bayonets were the long rows of men with carbines and M1s. And beside them, the Tommy guns. Not as accurate, but with much more firepower, cutting down the enemy. And just a few hundred yards to the rear, the water-cooled machine gun, spitting out hundreds of rounds a minute. And although there were no enemy tanks to speak of, our anti-tank weapons, the bazooka and the recoilless rifle, were used to pin down communist clusters before they could leave their hiding places. And behind them, the men with mortars, lobbing in their shells. All day and all night, our heavy tanks prowled the area, waiting for the mines to be lifted.
Tanks, go on up through our position.
Acting as frontline weapons, the Navy sent its corsairs in, strafing and bombing with fantastic accuracy, the targets which the infantry observation posts pinpointed by radio. Behind all this, the big guns, the 155s, pounded away at enemy positions. the beginning, even this enormous wall of firepower had to give before the savage onslaught. The 2nd Division split down the middle. A South Korean division almost collapsed. But by Sunday, the Korean unit had regrouped itself, and General Tiny Ruffner's 2nd Division had used its temporary split as a vice, which in a 24-hour period killed more men than make up an American division, almost 15,000. All day and all night, the Air Force sent its bombers overhead, hitting the enemy in his staging areas. And on the east coast of the Korean Peninsula, the battleship New Jersey lay at anchor, and like a floating gun platform, struck the enemy hard at Wonsan. The New Jersey was hit by enemy shore batteries, but is still in combat. On Saturday, the enemy attack began to stall. On Sunday, the Allied line, from carbine to mortar to 155s, stepped up their attack. On Sunday evening, General Almond of the 10th Corps reported that his men had killed or wounded 24,000 Reds in that one day. On Monday, the Reds reached their deepest point of penetration. By evening, the retreat was beginning. Allied patrols went in after them. Our defense became an offense. By Thursday, some divisions had gained as much as 6 miles. Some patrols had again crossed the 38th parallel. Yesterday, General Van Fleet summed it up for us.
The enemy achieved an initial deep penetration in the Republic of Korea sector, which constituted a serious threat to United Nations positions, and reserves were rushed to the threatened areas. But again, as in the February offensive, the gallant 2nd United States Division, with attached equally gallant French and Netherlands battalions, bore the brunt of the assault. This magnificent fighting force under Major General Ruffner stopped the enemy cold. The carefully prepared United Nations defensive positions, employing 3 bands of double apron barbed wire entanglements, protected by mines and covered by the heaviest concentration of artillery yet encountered in the Korean War, inflicted crippling casualties to the enemy. Also, prisoner reports have attested to the effectiveness of both 8th Army artillery and the night bombing attacks of the Air Force, which in many cases broke up attacks before the enemy assault units could leave assembly areas. The situation, then, is one to inspire full gratification but not undue optimism. The enemy tactics of precipitous withdrawal followed by violent counteraction are too well known. But it is sufficient to say that the enemy has been severely defeated in his so-called second phase of action, and his initial success with deep penetration was turned into a complete failure.
Secretary of Defense Marshall, who is no easy optimist, said this to the boys at the front.
The lights are going up again all over the free world, and they're growing brighter day by day. I say to you, courageous men, you're fighting to great purpose because you have a great purpose to fight for. May God bless you and protect you in the great battle now in progress.
Out in Wichita, Kansas, there was considerable pride in a grocery store on one of the unfashionable streets. The son of grocer John Jabara had, over the weekend, become the world's first jet ace. By tradition, an ace is a pilot who has shot down 5 or more enemy planes. Captain Jabara had become an ace over Germany in the last war. Last Saturday, over North Korea, not far from the border, he knocked down numbers 5 and 6 for this war. 2 Russian MiGs at 20,000 feet in less than 3 minutes. Out at the Jabara grocery in Wichita, his father, an immigrant who came to America in 1911, sat down and wrote his son a telegram. We recorded him reading it.
Today that I am bursting with pride. I thought I was proud of you when you were 8 years old. When you started working beside me in the grocery store after school. I thought I was proud of you that night when you received your diploma from the North High. I thought my pride had reached its peak during World War II, when you downed 6 enemy planes over Germany. But no father in the entire United States could possibly be as proud as I am today. Tears fill my eyes as your old friend and neighbor shower me with the congregation's good wishes, which are really meant for you, my son. The whole world is claiming your bravery. Please let your father pause for a moment in all the excitement to say, good work, Jimmy. May God always be with you.
Another American paid tribute to the men fighting in Korea. Harry S. Truman, who is never so good or unpredictable as when he throws away his prepared speeches and says what's on his mind, stood before a banquet audience in Washington. But his words were for the men listening to the Armed Forces radio in Korea.
When we sit here tonight, in our evening clothes, partaking of food off of white tablecloths, and enjoying ourselves in other ways, bear in mind that there are men fighting and dying in an endeavor to reach that peace for which we've been striving since World War ceased. In order to accomplish that purpose, you must quit your bickering here at home. You must quit playing petty politics. You must remember that there are certain things that have to be done here at home if we're going to accomplish this purpose in the world. We're fighting for time. The young men in Korea and Japan are fighting for time for us. There's always an emphasis on the casualties in Korea. Of course, when there's fighting, there are casualties. But did it ever occur to you that if this necessity with which we are faced is not met, that the casualties in Korea will be one small drop in a bucket? One of those horrible bombs of which we talk so much. Think what a responsibility your president faces in a situation of this kind. If you'd think and think clearly on this subject, you'd get behind him and help him to win this peace, and that's what I'm asking you to do, and that's what our armed services in Korea wants you to do. I hope every one of you will go home. Get down on your knees and pray for guidance to do the right thing, that these young men that are now fighting on the battlefields of Korea shall not die in vain. It's up to you.
Two illustrious senators, both tall trees in the forest of presidential possibilities, spoke this week. Robert Taft of Ohio and Paul Douglas of Illinois spoke at the American Assembly at Arden, New York. And both senators were able to concede that in a Washington atmosphere of disunity, there is a considerable area of agreement. As Senator Taft put it,
I think it may be said today that there is a very wide agreement on this principal purpose of our foreign policy today. And that all of us agree that a policy must be adopted to contain communism where it is today and to prevent its extension. I think it may be said that we agree on the basic strategy of that policy today, and that the differences which have arisen relate rather to the tactics by which that strategy shall be carried out.
Senator Paul Douglas, a Democrat and an old Marine, claimed that Taft was writing off the importance of the infantry division.
The scientist always wants to abolish the infantryman and to transform a war into a push-button affair, in which science is dominant. But in every war that has occurred, it's the human spirit that is ultimately tested, and it is the land armies and the infantrymen who ultimately make the difference between success and failure.
The senator from Ohio on future wars.
I do not think that we should undertake to go to war to improve the standard of living of other peoples or to maintain their liberty. It is undoubtedly true. I differed very strongly with Mr. Roosevelt in his idea that we should go to war to protect the four freedoms throughout the world. And we went to war, and the four freedoms probably cover less of the world than they ever did before. I do not believe that the protection of the liberty of other people in itself justifies war, which in the end may perhaps destroy more liberty in the world than it will ever restore. Certainly in Korea, the effort to restore liberty, protect the liberty of the South Koreans, has only resulted so far in the destruction of South Korea.
The MacArthur hearings continued, with General Bradley on the witness stand. The crowded hearings of 2 weeks ago were gone. Although the testimony had passed the million-word mark, fewer and fewer senators were appearing and even less entering the debate. Senator Charles Toby, Republican from New Hampshire, arose on Tuesday and told his fellow senators that he thought the hearings had gone far enough.
Mr. Chairman, I have no questions. I have an observation I would like to make, if it be in order. Here are a lot of men, well-intentioned men, but with absolutely no military training or military gumption or common sense, coming in here to pose questions to men whose lifelong services have been in the military and naval establishments and the Air Force of this country. We have got the whole country by the ears putting out bulletins. Mr. Stalin subscribes to them day after day. We are wisely holding closed hearings over open hearings against the ill advisement of some members of this committee who had insisted upon the hearings being open. And so what are we doing? We are getting opinion. We are asking questions, many of them being very, very piddling, if I can use that word. And here we have the country looking upon us a little askance as to what has come over the Congress of the United States and the nation. When we get all through, Mr. MacArthur will still be deposed from his position. Mr. Marshall will still be the man in charge of the defense of this country. And the Joint Chiefs will still be the same three men they are now. Let us get on to ourselves and be strong and forget little piddling stuff and the gratification of asking questions and mixing up the gears and throwing sand in the gearbox. And I want to say also as a Republican that in my honest judgment, while we may not realize it ourselves, we Republicans and we Democrats, but there is a very distinct political trend in a lot of these hearings, subconsciously at least. I think the whole thing is unfortunate. I wish you could ring the curtain down for the good of the country and the men in the service in Korea and for generations to come. That is all I have to say. I speak frankly because I feel that way.
Two of the Joint Chiefs testified before the senators this week. The chairman, General Omar Bradley, and the Army Chief of Staff, General Lightning Joe Collins. General Bradley, winding up 6 days of testimony yesterday, made it known for the first time that the Joint Chiefs on at least two occasions had sent General MacArthur directives on how to run the war in Korea. Bradley said that twice the Joint Chiefs told MacArthur that they were afraid the 8th Army and the 10th Corps, separated as they were during the unsuccessful Yalu offensive last November, might run into trouble. General MacArthur, when he was the witness, defended the way he had these two units spread out, said he would do it again if he had to. Today, as General Collins took the stand for the first time, he told of another occasion when MacArthur had been instructed not to use any troops but South Koreans when he launched a drive to the enemy frontier near the Yalu River. Nevertheless, General MacArthur did send American troops to the Yalu. And when the Joint Chiefs asked why he did, the general replied from Tokyo, because it was a military necessity. Tonight, MacArthur's aide explained, after the South Koreans were destroyed near the Yalu, it was essential to send up American forces. General Collins returns to the witness stand tomorrow. He has given every indication of agreeing completely with General Bradley and Secretary of Defense Marshall that it was necessary to recall General MacArthur because MacArthur was not in sympathy with basic policies agreed upon in Washington, and because MacArthur failed to clear his public statements on policy matters as directed. But not all the energies of the Congress are devoted to matters of great moment or repetitious hearings. Tonight, Republicans and Democrats will, barring rain, drop any guise of immunity, and for the benefit of Washington's underprivileged youngsters, go out and oppose each other on the baseball diamond, in a letting off of steam which should do the lawmakers as much good as an afternoon of speech-making in Congress would do Leo DeRocher or Casey Stengel. Republican Captain Runt Bishop of Illinois warns his opponents in a nonpartisan way.
You know, they're talking about slipping or this or that, but Senator Kiofer of Tennessee is going to be out there selling hot dogs again to watch over the misdoings of your people. You know, he's been looking after you for the last year or so.
Fishbait Miller, the official doorkeeper of the Congress, is the official manager of the Democratic Nine.
As the nonpartisan manager of the Democratic team, who was elected by nonpartisan Democrats, I want to give you my nonpartisan prediction of this game and that is that the Democrats will win by anywhere from 6 to 10 runs.
The non-playing custodian of the GOP rights on the diamond will be that guardian of so many other civil rights, the junior senator from New Hampshire.
I just want to say that the Senate Crime Investigating Committee will keep an eagle eye on this game. We will not tolerate any stealing of bases unless such larceny is carried out in accordance with rules and regulations and with respect to common decency. Our committee is also aware of the shameless rumor that one of the players is supposed to have bribed his way into the game. I won't say to which party this congressman belongs, because we do not want partisan politics to enter our investigation. But we can state, frankly, that this rumor, spread with the Democrats, is entirely false. Yes, the congressman in question bought 50 box seats, but that had nothing to do with his being named to the team. The fact is, he was chosen for his hitting power and not his purchasing power. And finally, our committee has just one admonition to the congressional ballplayers. Be ye clean, even though your trousers be muddied on the playing field.
This reporter does not pretend to know enough about either baseball or politics to agree or disagree with the congressman who suggested that the winner of tonight's game be automatically judged the winner of the 1952 elections. There were two old soldiers in the news this week, Albert Wilson and William J. Bush, both infantrymen, both interested observers of the current war. But this week and next, looking back on other battles and other wars.
All the boys and girls in Duluth Public Schools are now contributing to what is called Operation Pennies, which will pay for the painting of a portrait of Duluth's last surviving Civil War veteran, Mr. Albert Wilson. In a special community observance on Memorial Day, we will pay tribute to Mr. Wilson.
That was the voice of a schoolchild in Duluth, Minnesota, where Albert Wilson, a veteran of Minnesota's Company C, is at 104 one of the few links left between Bull Run and today. Because this is the last year in which the veterans of the Confederacy are to meet, we also have sought out a soldier who fought for the South, William J. Bush, 106, of Fitzgerald, Georgia. Both Mr. Wilson and Mr. Bush are spry in spirit and have kept up with the times and the news. Now, as then, the representatives of the North and South still find certain areas for disagreement. For example, on the subject of the president, Mr. Bush remains rebellious.
President Truman made a mistake in bringing General MacArthur back to the United States. I think that President Truman should have called him Congress before he called him back home.
But the man who fought under Lincoln and Grant likes the man from Missouri.
I think that Mr. Truman is an honorable, patriotic gentleman. And I understand from what I see in the daily papers that he has a very important job on his hand. And I do not think that very many men would like to step in his shoes.
On the subject of communism, veteran Wilson expects to outlive that, too.
As to the danger of war, my private opinion goes back to the days of the Tsar of Russia. The common people of Russia are not ignorant people by any means. And if Joseph Stalin and his hothead advisors persist in their courts, I predict it will Mr. Stalin's treatment he'll receive from his constituents. He will be removed from office.
Turning to the Confederates again, we also asked the gentleman from Georgia what he thought of President Lincoln, his old foe.
Abraham Lincoln was a dandy.
Abraham Lincoln was a dandy. What about his old commander, General Lee?
Robert E. Lee never has been beat and never will. We've got but few men in this United States of America that's come up with Robert E. Lee.
Though not a five-star general, as far as age is concerned, General Bush is certainly at 106, the ranking American general as far as age in grade is concerned. We asked him when he was promoted to general.
When did I get promoted as general? Well, I ought to have been there all my life.
Both Mr. Wilson and Mr. Bush are unanimous in their confidence in America's destiny. Veteran Wilson expressed his as the Duluth school children sang in the background.
Our flag is on high. We're going to win out. I defy any three nations. This little old world wants to tackle America when we throw them out. Our flag is on high. We're going to win out.
You are listening to Hear It Now, CBS's weekly document for air based on the week's news. The program continues immediately after this pause for station identification. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System. This is Program 24 on Hear It Now, a full-hour review of the week's news told in the actual recorded voices of the men and women who make the news. Once again, here is the editor of Hear It Now, Edward R. Murrow.
The President of the United States this week broke a tradition as old as radio and extending down from Coolidge to Hoover to Roosevelt to Truman when he permitted part of his Thursday news conference to be recorded. Not on broadcast equipment, to be sure, but even on a dictating machine. His confidence, as he put it, was quite obvious.
I do have a comment that I want to make to you. That I want to have an understanding with you on. Some of my good friends who write columns and whom I read with pleasure have been saying lately that I had a cocky attitude. Now, I don't like that word because I think it's confident that they want to say. And if you remember after the election in 1948, I was exceedingly careful not to appear cocky or as if I wanted to press somebody down. I'm not in that mood now. I think, however, that the program and policies that the executive has been endeavoring to put into effect are right. And I think that the people of the United States and of the world believe that they are right, and I'm confident that those policies will go into effect, legislatively and otherwise, because they are right. And I don't want to assume any cocky attitude toward anybody, no matter who he is.
For the past week, there has been a feeling of confidence and almost a hint of optimism in Washington. There has been much speculation as to the cause of this optimism. Some say the result of the fighting in Korea. Others say Bradley's testimony, part of which has been censored. Still others say we have secret weapons about to go into combat. Regardless of the reason, there has been a close examination in both the press and radio of the possibilities of new weapons. The Atomic Energy Commission said today it has successfully carried out tests, including some contributing to the hydrogen bomb. There are reports of atomic warheads and, of course, guided missiles. Guided missiles, which are, of course, highly secret. But being both curious and optimistic, we asked the Pentagon if they had ever recorded a guided missile in flight. They had. A recording of a V-2 rocket with a WAC Corporal. WAC Corporal, that's the wartime code name for the rocket that piggybacks a ride on the V-2. It was a flight made off the desert of White Sands, New Mexico. A flight that carried the daughter part of the mother-daughter combination to a height of 250 miles and down, all in less than 12 minutes.
White Sands Proving Ground. This is round 5 of the bumper rocket.
15 tons of rocket are ready to go. Nearby, in a concrete blockhouse, under a 14-foot roof of concrete, the men who run the rockets are ready. They look out from glass windows, 6 inches thick, to watch the takeoff, make sure everything is right. Keep their eyes on the orange flame that will come from the tail of the V-2 as she moves slowly, a bit erratically, off the ground. And they listen to a receiver that is bringing back to the blockhouse a signal they have sent to the rocket. Now the V-2 is ready. Listen to the rocket's recorded sound on the ground, and then the signal that the rocket is starting to rise. Really traveling now, thousands of feet a second, and we're going to go a lot faster. In the first 45 seconds of this flight, the giant V-2 did most of its job, carried the WAC corporal to 40,000 feet. It takes our big bombers at least 30 minutes to get this high. After 1 minute, the V-2 has done its whole job, spent its fuel, and the daughter part of the combination takes off alone, under her own power, for greater speed and greater height. More than 2 minutes have passed. The little rocket, the WAC corporal, is propelling herself upward. But she, too, begins to lose fuel. And when she does, her momentum carries her along. She coasts. We have now reached maximum speed, but we're still going up. The power of our start will carry us to 250 miles. We're more than 100 miles high right now, going almost straight up, but not quite. Because the experts down below don't want to take any chance of having their experimental baby fall back on their head. The speed of the rocket is indicated to the experts in the blockhouse down below by the tone you hear. The tone begins to drop. So does the speed. 5.5 minutes after the rocket has left the ground, she attains the speed of 5,000 miles an hour. If an airplane could go that fast, you could leave New York, fly to the West Coast for a quick hello, and fly back within 1 hour. But the rocket, she's still going up, although at a slower pace. Now we're coming to the end of one part of the rocket flight. In a few seconds, the upward motion of the rocket will have stopped. It will have reached a height of 250 miles, as high as the distance from Detroit to Buffalo. We're at the top of the flight. The rocket slowly reaches its crest and lazily starts downward. Like a motorist at a strange crossroad, the WAC corporal seems to be having trouble deciding which way to go. But the force of gravity is the traffic cop up there at 250 miles. The rocket tumbles and tumbles and finally picks her straight course. She's headed for a point 80 miles distant on the ground from where she started, picking up speed as she goes. If this were a weapon of war instead of an experimental rocket, used by our scientists the better to understand the weapons of war, the force and speed and explosive power of the rocket would be aiming directly at an enemy city and coming down fast. For rockets, it takes longer to get down than it does to get up. The V-2 and the WAC corporal both used their own power to climb. Now there is no power but the power of gravity pulling the rocket down. And as it approaches the Earth, there are other factors that prevent an increase in its speed. Back under that 14-foot concrete roof at White Sands, the experts notice what you hear now. A reduction in the pitch of the sound signal. The mathematicians have it all worked out with the theory and the figures. We know it's coming down close to its mythical target. tone has ended and the flight has ended. You hear no sound because the crash of the rocket has destroyed the gadget which reflected the radio signal the rocket experts had been sending out. Now comes the time for checking and learning and planning improvements. This record-breaking flight, 250 miles from the Earth's surface, the greatest announced height ever reached by a man-made object, is but another experiment in the armed forces' behind-the-scenes planning to make America strong. Out in another part of the West, another experiment was conducted by the armed forces. This one, a defensive one, to determine just how certain buildings and steel and concrete react to massive explosions. At Dugway, Utah, in a condemned area, Army engineers set off the largest non-atomic explosion in history. More than 320,000 pounds of TNT were set off.
We are now standing by the shortwave truck waiting for the...
15, 14, 13, 12, 11, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
There it goes.
Sound travels much slower than light, so the observers see it several seconds before they hear it.
A huge mushroom of black smoke and dust and clay which has been baked here in the sun of Dugway Valley at Dugway Proving Grounds for the last 3 weeks under a hot sun.
But of all the strange sounds that we recorded in the news this week, perhaps the strangest was this.
Relaxing more.
You are listening to the voice of Dr. Ernst Schmidhofer, chief psychiatrist of the Veterans Administration Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee. Dr. Schmidhofer has spent many years grappling with the problem of combat veterans whose nightmares will not let them sleep. Last week, he reported to a medical convention on his new sleep program for the battle-weary GIs. Dr. Schmidhofer broadcasts a long, monotonous recording of his voice all night long throughout the sleep wards of his hospital. Instead of keeping the men awake, as might be supposed, Dr. Schmidhofer claims considerable success in lulling his patients to sleep. Furthermore, he says that these men don't lose their newfound ability once they leave the hospital. Here is a brief sampling of Dr. Schmidhofer's sleep program.
I can rid myself of any symptoms completely and in less than a minute. I can rid myself of any symptoms completely and in less than a minute. I can rid myself of any symptoms completely and in less than a minute. Pay attention. I'm not overly dependent on medicines or doctors. I'm not overly dependent on medicines or doctors.
Dr. Schmidhofer makes it clear that this is an experimental program and by no means a cure-all.
My statements, conclusions, and implications are the result of my own studies and do not necessarily reflect the opinions or policies of the Veterans Administration. You see, its stand is one of wholesome scrutiny, and I am very pleased that it has given me the opportunity and the privilege of extending these observations.
A man who called himself a peddler and a salesman, and who once caused a considerable emotional explosion, was on the road this week and stopped off in Cleveland to help sell his book to the National Association of Book Dealers. Edward, Duke of Windsor.
For I, too, have done a bit of selling. As a matter of fact, I have spent a good many years on the road myself. And the 146,000 odd miles I traveled on Imperial missions would not compare unfavorably with the total mileage of any other salesman or woman here today. While furthering imperial interests may seem far removed from retailing, I maintain that selling is selling, whether it is selling a book from a sample case or an empire from a battle cruiser. For in the end, the art of selling comes down to knowing the customer and what he wants, and whether he likes it or not. The sooner every salesman learns the old rule that the customer is always right, the better off he is. But we all know there is a good deal more to salesmanship than can be expressed in any formula, even so basic a one as this old jingle. He who whispers down a well about the wares he has to sell will never reap the golden dollars like him who shows them round and hollers.
And a personal word from the Duke, who helps to write and also reads the gossip columns.
One final thought in what I have to say to you today. While a king's story is strictly non-fiction, I do believe that as far as its last chapters are concerned, it is, in a personal sense, a romance. And speaking for the lovely and wonderful lady to whom the book is dedicated, and for myself, I only wish that I had thought to add the old familiar ending of all romances, and they lived happily ever after.
There was another kind of prince looking for a job, but this one was on Broadway, and there were 73 of them. This is Richard Rodgers of the highly successful team of Rodgers and Hammerstein, which produced South Pacific and Oklahoma, auditioning for a new boy prince for their current hit musical, The King and I. The King and I is a musical version of Anna and the King of Siam. One of the leads is the part of Crown Prince Jula Longhorn. The current prince is leaving for Hollywood. And so difficult was the business of finding a new prince that the Rodgers and Hammerstein press agent resorted to an ad in the New York papers.
Wanted, Crown Prince of Siam, for the musical smash, The King and I. Preferably of Oriental appearance, must be able to sing and act. Age 12 to 15, height 5 feet to 5 feet 6 inches. Apply at 4 o'clock. Tomorrow afternoon, May 22, at the stage door of the St. James Theater, 44th Street, west of Broadway.
One of our reporters went by the theater to see the turnout. There were 73, and they were of every shape, size, and color. We recorded some of the sounds. The winner and new prince, Jackie Collins of Brooklyn and now of Siam.
Prince Jula Longhorn, Jackie Collins, 375 61st Street, Brooklyn, New York. There were four finalists. Then they told us that I got it. I felt very, very excited indeed.
We are about to take you to a dusty, battered, beat-up brick building, bomb-scarred and windowless, in the Korean city of Seoul. You will hear at first hand a military operation that is uniquely American. For some reason, American troops, whether it be in Africa, Italy, France, Germany, Britain, or Korea, cannot resist kids. They adopt as individuals or as units those slow, smiling, trusting youngsters who are part of the human wreckage left in the wake of war. We don't know why it is that American troops do this more than the troops of other nations, but they do. Some few million of you may remember the phrases, any gum, chum, cigarette for papa, chocolate, or no mama, no papa, no per diem. You may remember the excitement and the satisfaction of teaching a French or Italian kid a few words of English, of watching them grow strong and healthy on army rations, their fierce loyalty to the outfit, the pride with which they wore the cut-down uniform with the sergeant's stripes on the sleeve. The same thing has been happening in Korea. But finally, the time came when a lot of men in the 1st Cav Division were due to leave for home on rotation. That produced what was called Operation Mascot. A chaplain of the 1st Cavalry, standing in that battered school building in Seoul, explains the problem.
These youngsters, in rags, dirty, undernourished, the boys felt for them. And in many cases, they took off their shirt or put a blanket around them and took care of them. The men are getting rotated now. They're going back to the States. And they don't have a chance to take them with them. I mean, you can't just put them in your duffel bag. And you can't leave them out in the street either.
A young lieutenant from Colorado brings in a little boy. He's been with the outfit since last November. The lieutenant has collected $275 to pay for his keep in an orphanage in Taegu. The lieutenant explains how they acquired him.
He was ready to move out. He was eating some old sea rations. He'd been living up in a cave when we picked him up. And there we decided to take him on in, brought him some clothes and give him a bath. That was about it.
Another youngster, 3 or 4 years old, is brought in by a GI.
Our patrol's out looking for contact the enemy, found him in the no man's land, actually starved to death. He was in one room of a Korean house, and his mother, apparently, the best we can find out, his mother, was in another room, dead, been dead several days, badly decomposed. The little fellow was practically starved to death. The boys gave him a little sugar out of their rations, a slice of bread. We wouldn't give him too much because I didn't want to make him sick.
A soldier brings in a little girl, about 7, for Operation Mascot. At one time, he tried to leave her at a Korean police station, but he said...
That afternoon it began to rain. I felt a little bit sorry for her and left the division rear, going back to the police station to give her a little blanket or a poncho. Instead, she met me on the way back. I find out she raised much devilment that they turned her loose.
Many of these kids have no memory of their family or where they come from. Their life and their loyalty are wrapped up in the outfit.
What's your name?
Joe.
Joe, what outfit are you with?
7th Cavalry Regiment Headquarters Company.
That a boy. How old are you, Zach?
10.
10 years old, huh?
Where are you from, Bert?
1st Cavalry Division, 15th Rank of Battalion, Clear Company, 2nd Platoon.
1st Cavalry Division, 15th Medical Battalion, Charlie Company, 2nd Platoon. The Army issue won't fit 6- and 8-year-olds. One platoon solved that problem this way.
They gave him a little uniform. It didn't fit quite well enough. Some of the boys thought, why don't we write to one of these catalog outfits and get him a Hopalong Cassidy suit with the 2-gun pearl-handled pistols.
GI ingenuity can solve most problems.
Where'd he get that cowboy outfit?
We got it from Sears and Roebuck in California.
You sent back after?
Yeah.
How do you like that suit? You like it?
Number one.
Number one, huh?
Atta boy.
Things don't come any better than number one in Korea. Here's an interview with another Korean cowboy.
What's your name?
My name's Billy.
Where are you from, Benny?
Taegu.
You're from Taegu?
Yeah.
Where'd you get that cowboy outfit?
Go stage.
Where?
Go stage.
Stage?
Yeah.
steak.
Yes, sir.
Uh-huh. Is that a Hopalong Cassidy outfit?
Maybe.
Maybe. That's a nice gun.
Yeah.
Show me your gun. What kind is it?
Texas Junior gun.
It's a Texas Junior. Who's your friend over here?
Jimmy.
How old are you, Jimmy? Come here.
Nine.
You're Jimmy?
Yeah. You're talking
about. How old did you say you were, Benny?
11.
You're 11, huh?
Yes, sir.
Uh-huh. And you fellas good friends?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Where are you going now?
Going to school.
You go to school?
Yeah.
Good. Can you read?
Mama can read. Go to school. Mama can read.
That's right. You're going to learn to read, aren't you?
Yeah.
Sure. Where's your papa? Where's your GI friends?
Captain Johnson,
he's gone. Before the children are sent off to the orphanage in Taegu, and the battle-weary soldiers are sent home on rotation, the children must be inoculated. They don't like that needle. Some of the soldiers who have been shot with everything in the book roll up their sleeves and take another one, just to prove that it won't hurt. No real parents were ever prouder of those who performed well.
How'd that feel, huh? Did that hurt?
Too hard.
Too hard?
Was that too hard?
Yeah.
I think so,
John. Okay. Oh, he was a brave boy.
And a little girl who was perhaps not quite so brave.
I'm so scared.
Yes.
Okay, said she'll take a shot if I take her to the house.
I'm not
following. Ask our little girl.
What?
Ask our little girl.
I'm going back. Hey,
be happy, yes?
Look.
Look. See? Okay.
I'm not
you take one? Oh, now put your arm up like a good girl.
That's a child.
It's just a little child.
No.
Baby, don't do that.
Okay.
It's all over now.
Troop morale is very important at a time like this. One little fellow who's had his shot strikes up a song to show the others that it didn't hurt a bit.
Shouting good night. Shouting good night. Good night.
And if you're in a cavalry outfit, even if you're only 9 years old and a Korean with no home and no family, you must know the old cavalry song.
Our down her neck, she wore the 11, she wore for the level for in the cavalry. Cavalry, cavalry.
It's time for the kids to head south for the orphanage in Taegu, and for the soldiers to head for the States. Those who were there say that the children weren't the only ones who cried.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, bye-bye, Dottie. Bye-bye. Be a good
bye-bye.
Girl.
Hey, Dottie.
And just before they left, a young lieutenant brought in a little girl to Operation Mascot. Probably the only arms she remembered had been encased in khaki. Certainly, that uniform represented what she had known of tenderness, understanding, and security. She did not want to let go.
This little girl has been picked up and been following the 3rd Division rear for about 2 months. Her last name is Lee. I don't know her full name. I have it written down here. It's all right, baby, son. Okay.
Obviously, she doesn't want to leave you.
Sit down. Enough.
You come back.
Talk.
Okay. I'm
never done.
Let me die.
Don. Have some candy.
No candy. No candy.
Listen, you stay here. And we'll come by and see.
That was part of what we recorded of Operation Mascot. The children will be well taken care of in one of the orphanages in Taegu. They have seen and heard terrible things, but they may grow up in freedom and dignity instead of slavery. That's one of the things this war is about. All armies are brutal, profane, and trained to kill. In the last week, our armies in Korea have practiced their profession with great skill and much glory. They also conducted Operation Mascot. That, too, was of some importance, beyond the call of duty, and in the best tradition of troops who value the lives of little children while being willing to spend their own so freely.
The men are getting rotated now. They're going back to the States. And they don't have a chance to take them with them. I mean, you can't just put them in your duffel bag. And you can't leave them out in the street either.
Just heard program 24 in the CBS series, Hear It Now, a document for ear based on the week's news. Hear It Now is edited and produced by Edward R. Murrow and Fred W. Friendly, and a CBS staff which includes John Aaron, Jesse Zausmer, Irving Gitlin, Edmund Scott, and Joseph Wershfer. Portions of the program originated at WTOP Washington, WREC Memphis, KDAL Duluth, KFH Wichita, WGAR Cleveland, KSL Salt Lake City, WMAZ Macon, Georgia, WEEI Boston, and KCBS San Francisco. Combat recordings were made in Korea by CBS correspondent John Jefferson and by Armed Forces radio teams. Operation Mascot was recorded in the field by CBS correspondent Robert Pierpoint. Edward R. Murrow can be heard over most of the CBS stations Monday through Friday at 7:45 p.m. Eastern Time. This is Olin Tice speaking.
Silence may be golden, but silence when someone else is talking the doctrine of hate and intolerance is a cheap tarnished thing. This hate talk, this stupid talk against fellow Americans because of their race, color, or religious creeds can hurt you and your family. It weakens our nation at home and in the eyes of the world. So be sure you speak out wherever you are against intolerance. Work actively for understanding. Do your part to build the United America that will benefit us all. America is currently busy fighting two enemies, aggression and inflation. The aggression must be combated with more materials for our armed forces, and inflation can be fought by the increased production of much-needed civilian goods. Keep America free. Keep our standard of living high. Keep on producing to the best of your ability. And are you looking forward to the day when you have plenty of leisure time and enough money to pursue that hobby of yours? Well, that day in the future can become a reality very simply and easily when you invest in United States defense bonds. These are one of the safest, wisest ways to save for your future and that of your family. Regular saving is easy and automatic if you sign up for the payroll savings plan where you work or with the bond a month plan where you bank. Remember, automatic saving is sure saving. Invest in United States defense bonds. This is CBS, where you laugh at Jack Benny, Sunday nights, the Columbia Broadcasting System.